Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools have been here on 3CR since 1987, but we've been in existence since 1964. And we are defending and we are promoting public education. And in order to do that, of course, we have to oppose the state aid going to the private sector, which is now in billions and billions of dollars and is making us the most segregated country in the world. And one might even say that it's even produced somebody who wants to talk about monoculture, whatever that is. Very interesting times that we live in. But we're going to start off today talking about teachers. The teachers' union is very close to the government and has been for a long time, the Labor government. And there is a group of rank and file teachers, and there always has been in Victoria, who have no illusions about the corridors of power and deals that are done there. And they are not happy with the deal that the AEU Victoria has made with the Allan government. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Sue Phillips from the World Socialist website. Victorian educators reject AEU Labor sellout, build rank and file committees to take the struggle forward. In a blow to the Australian Education Union, AEU bureaucracy, and the Allan Labor government, Victorian public school teachers, education support staff, ES, and school principals have voted 57.7% to 42.3% to reject the union's proposed four-year industrial agreement. This is the first time in more than four decades that educators have voted down an AEU-endorsed deal. The vote is an indictment of the agreement cooked up in secret between AEU officials and Premier Jacinta Allan's government following the powerful March 24 statewide strike, in which more than 35,000 educators marched through Melbourne. That strike demonstrated the fighting spirit of educators, winning broad support among parents and workers. The AEU leadership's response was to water down and call off further industrial action, return to closed-door negotiations, and produce a deal that locks in real pay cuts and does nothing to cap class sizes or reduce crushing workloads. The overwhelming no vote was registered despite anti-democratic mechanisms the AEU deployed in an attempt to ram the deal through. This was not a one-member, one-vote ballot. Instead, a delegate assigned from the union's internal database cast a vote on behalf of every 20 financial members after a sub-branch meeting. There were no rank-and-file scrutineers and no means for members to confirm their sub-branch's votes were accurately recorded. The union apparatus controlled every lever of the process and still lost. That result was achieved despite a systematic campaign of misinformation, censorship and intimidation. The AEU deleted critical comments from its Facebook pages, blocked members who asked legitimate questions, and ruled opposition resolutions out of order at stage-managed briefings. These were the same methods the AEU used to ram through a 2022 sellout agreement, which included pay rises of less than 2% per annum, locking teachers into real wage cuts throughout the cost of living crisis. The rejection of the 2026 sellout is not only a response to this agreement, but reflects widespread anger among educators over the 2022 deal and decades of regressive agreements. The bureaucracy's false claims. In the immediate aftermath of the vote, AEU State President Justin Mullaly rushed out a statement claiming the union had listened to and heard members' concerns and that the way forward was to stick together and stay united. This is a brazen fraud. The union leadership has no intention of allowing this opposition vote to be the last word. It has sought to ram through attacks on educators' conditions in defiance of mass opposition, demonstrating that it stands on the side of the big business Labor government and the corporate elite. Educators be warned, they will now turn their attention to imposing the demands of the government in another form. The call for unity is equally hollow. The AEU has systematically divided the workforce. ES staff, among the lowest paid workers in schools, many holding second jobs while performing increasingly complex medical, special needs and behavioural support roles, were offered a deal even worse than that presented to teachers, with a one-off allowance substituting for a genuine wage increase. The bureaucracy made no effort to unite teachers and ES workers in a common fight. Instead, it sought to split them and ram through separate outcomes. Nor has the AEU called for unity with educators in other states. Teachers in Tasmania, Queensland, the ACT, and nationally are confronting the same crisis of real wage cuts, ballooning workloads, and collapsing school infrastructure. Thousands are leaving the profession due to unbearable conditions and burnout, deepening the staffing crisis in public education. The AEU has deliberately kept these struggles isolated, fearing precisely the kind of unified national movement that could pose a genuine political challenge to the federal Labor government and financial elite it serves. Within hours of the result, the union's Joint Primary and Secondary Council passed a resolution that amounts to a desperate operation to regain control of a membership in revolt. The same officials who stitched up the May 15 deal, which they assured members was the best deal ever, are now appealing for immediate negotiations with the Department of Education. The resolution commits the union to restart negotiations immediately before any consultation with members has even taken place. The centrepiece of the bureaucracy's way forward is a member survey to be emailed next week. This is a classic bureaucratic manoeuvre to atomise the membership, replace mass meetings and collective discussion with individualised tick boxes, and then claim to have listened. The resolution states that survey results will inform the decisions of the bureaucracy, not determine them. The Joint Council, a body of 120 delegates dominated by the union apparatus, will make the actual decisions at a meeting on July 17th, almost a month away. The purpose of the delay is to stall, dissipate the momentum generated by the no vote, and buy time for the bureaucracy to concoct another sellout behind closed doors. The AEU stated that it is lifting its suspension of industrial action, but announced only the toothless bans and limitations on work that were previously in place. There's no call for stop work, mass meetings, or democratic forums where teachers and ES staff can debate strategy together. The resolution itself notes that many members have recognised the strong pay outcomes in the government's offer, signalling that the bureaucracy intends to push essentially the same wage framework with cosmetic workload adjustments. The AEU apparatus is fighting to preserve its role as the industrial police force of the government. Assisting this process are pseudo-left groups such as Socialists in Schools and Fight the Crisis, which claim that one-day strikes can pressure the government and empower our negotiators to secure a better deal. Sending the same bureaucrats back to negotiate is a dead-end perspective. Its purpose to keep educators' rebellion trapped within the confines of the union apparatus. A political crisis for Labor. The rejection of the deal creates a political crisis for the Labor governments, not only in Victoria but federally. Labor at the national level and in most of the states is tasked by the corporate and financial elite with implementing sweeping cuts to social spending to make workers pay for the deepening crisis of capitalism. The Allan government, like every state and federal Labor government, is implementing an austerity program dictated by the corporate elite. Victoria is carrying out public sector sackings, pay cuts, and the destruction of public housing. Federally, the Albanese government's May budget contained $63.8 billion in cuts to social spending over 4 years, including the gutting of the NDIS, the largest cut to a social program in Australian history. The impact of these measures will be borne especially by ES staff and teachers not only in Victoria but nationally. Meanwhile, tens of billions are being poured into AUKUS and the US-led war against Iran. This agenda depends on the ability of the Union bureaucracies, including the AEU, to enforce sellouts and suppress workers' opposition. The no vote is an expression of the fact that these corporate mechanisms are breaking down. A global rebellion. This is part of an international rebellion of workers worldwide who are rejecting sellout deals imposed by trade union bureaucracies in collusion with governments and employers. From the United States to Britain, from New Zealand to across Europe, workers are confronting the same reality: union apparatuses that function as instruments of class discipline, not class struggle. At the Committee for Public Education online public meeting on the June 14th, international contributions highlighted this global experience. A California teacher described how the California Teachers Association ran a "We Can't Wait" campaign only to force through contracts that failed to keep pace with inflation. A New Zealand correspondent recounted how primary school teachers initially voted down a sellout deal, only for the union to present essentially the same agreement and wear them down into accepting it. The lesson was clear. A no vote, while crucial, is not enough. The union apparatus will regroup, repackage the offer, and try again. The way forward: rank and file committees. The task now is to take the struggle out of the hands of the AEU bureaucracy entirely. The Committee for Public Education, CFPE, has consistently argued that defeating this sellout requires building independent rank-and-file committees in every school, organisations democratically controlled by teachers and ES workers themselves, free from the censorship and sabotage of the union apparatus. Such committees are needed to break through the isolation the AEU imposes, share information across schools, formulate demands based on real needs, not what the government and union decide is affordable, and build solidarity with other sections of workers under attack: council workers, health workers, early childhood educators, university staff. They must connect nationally and internationally through the International Workers Alliance of Rank and File Committees, IWARFC. The demands that flow from this struggle go beyond any single agreement. An immediate 40% pay increase to recover past losses, including ES staff, with automatic cost of living adjustments. Maximum class sizes of 15 to 20. A minimum of 8 hours weekly during school hours for planning, assessment and collaboration. An end to public funding for elite private schools and the redirection of billions into a free, first-class public education for all. Educators have already shown their willingness to fight. The decisive task now is to build the organisations and leadership carrying that struggle forward. The defence of public education requires a socialist perspective. The resources exist to provide high-quality schools and decent pay and conditions, but they are monopolised by the billionaires, banks and corporations. These resources must be placed under public ownership and democratic control and redirected to meet social need, not private profit. Back to you, Jean.
Well, it's great, isn't it, to see people who are fighting for the teachers in our public schools and also for our public schools. Now, our next article is a bit complicated. There is a group of people who are very like-minded with the dogs, but who believe that perhaps you should have what's called an integrated system. You should let the religious schools have everything they want, but say that they have to be open in their enrolment policies. This is done in some other countries, but it doesn't necessarily work. And the dogs have to admit that we're not in favour of it. Neither is Trevor Kobold of Save Our Schools. But on the Save Our Schools website, there is an argument going on about this. And we believe in free speech, and even if we disagree with people, then we think they should also be heard. So Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner, who are promoting the integrated system, had this to say to the article which we read you last week from Trevor Kobold. So here it is, together with the dog's reply to it.
Thanks, Jane. Public education needs a level playing field to flourish, a reply to save our schools. And this was published by Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner. Trevor Cobbold and Save Our Schools have made a welcome and vigorous response to our proposal for a common framework for all Australian schools. The essence of the common framework is that all schools should be eligible for full needs-based public funding as long as they don't charge fees and they do adopt inclusive enrolment practices. Firstly, it is important to note an essential area of agreement, a deep shared commitment to public education understood as publicly owned, publicly governed and publicly accountable secular institutions operating under universal social obligations. This form of education embodies values of solidarity and fairness, citizenship and community that are an essential part of a good society, and it urgently needs to be promoted and strengthened. But for those very reasons, our common framework proposal, if implemented, would not see private schools as part of public education systems. They would exist alongside public schools as they do now, but with obligations and an operation which reflects their funding levels, which are, for most schools, very close to and sometimes more than government funding of public schools with similar demographics. That important clarification aside, our disagreement with Cobbold's paper begins when we turn to the overarching framework that determines how public education systems coexist alongside the two non-government sectors. The question is, what are the best conditions to enable public schools to flourish, given they inevitably exist in competition with privately owned and operated, mostly religious schools? Our argument is that the status quo is inherently corrosive to the project of public education because it gives the non-government schools two kinds of competitive advantage. Firstly, they are better resourced because they can charge fees in addition to generous public subsidies. Secondly, they can exclude, whether intentionally or otherwise, children who are more expensive to educate. Having to compete in this context fundamentally undermines the project of public education, exposing it to an inexorable dynamic of segregation and residualisation. This trend has reached exponential proportions in the last 8 years. Conversely, if all schools were resourced and regulated on a common basis, public education would be in a position to prosper, because then the competition would be on its merits, not about a rigged policy environment. Of course, some people would still choose a religious school because that's what they believe in, but not because it comes with better resourcing and an air of exclusivity. Neither would continue to be the case within a common framework. Here, Save Our Schools responds in three ways. Firstly, SOS views full public funding of religious schools as destroying public education in the name of reform and jettisoning the foundation principles of public education. But this is mistaken. Public schools remain public schools. The change is to non-government schools, which must take on commensurate public obligations in return for full public funding, just like non-government schools in many secular countries around the world, like Canada, the UK, and the Netherlands. In this fairer context, public schools now get to operate on a level playing field in which neighbouring schools are resourced equivalently and face commensurate public obligations. Secondly, Save Our Schools argues that the solution is to fully fund public schools and stop overfunding private schools. This is absolutely necessary for the compelling reasons advanced by Trevor Cobbold, amongst many others, including ourselves. But it is nowhere near sufficient. Even if public schools receive 100% of their SRS entitlement, private schools will still enjoy total resource advantages through the combination of public subsidy and unregulated fees. This is not acceptable. And they'll still be able to pick and choose their students. This is a continuation of the unlevel playing field, not a solution to it. Thirdly, Save Our Schools says a common framework is not politically possible because many private systems are highly unlikely to surrender the financial and structural privileges they currently enjoy. There certainly are no guarantees. The creative policy challenge is to forge the best policy outcome with the most realistic chance of success. The reason why the common framework proposal has a realistic chance of success is that it puts a big carrot on the table, full public funding. The non-government sectors are anything but a monolith, and this carrot is likely to strongly appeal to some sections, less so to others. It is more likely to appeal to parents who struggle to afford even modest fees and families for whom school fees are a major driver of bankruptcy. It's likely to appeal to the poor religious who are currently excluded from religious schools. It's going to have appeal for schools and systems leaders who are genuinely concerned about the underrepresentation of the poor in their schools and the larger issues of social segregation across our schooling landscape. A politician going to an election saying, "I'm going to address cost of living by completely removing one of the biggest pressures you are facing right now, school fees," is a plausible proposition. If some non-government school authorities reject this and insist on their right to charge ever-increasing fees, they are going to find themselves increasingly at odds with their own parent communities. They've also just undercut any appeal to school choice in defence of their existing privileges. This demonstrates how the appeal of the common framework extends well beyond the hip pocket. It addresses a basic grievance of the non-government sector that parents who want an education for their child that reflects their conscientious beliefs are denied access to fully publicly funded education. In this way, the common framework takes away the private school lobby's rhetorical trump card in public debate. Whenever exclusivity and privilege is challenged, they do not attempt to defend the indefensible, but change the subject. They present it as an attack on low-fee schools and make it a debate about the value of choice. And so they have been able to successfully hide taxpayer support for extremely wealthy schools behind the fig leaf of religious choice. The common framework undercuts this deceitful but effective tactic by advocating genuine choice accessible to all, not just those who can afford it, provided in a manner consistent with equity and overall student achievement. Sure, it will be still a huge challenge, but it has the ingredients to transform the conversation, the politics and the policy. Contrast this with the Gonski Plus model proposed by Save Our Schools, which limits taxpayer funding of private schools to filling any gap between private income and community resource standard. This proposal imagines that politicians are suddenly going to summon the courage, capacity, and political will to substantially cut private school funding. Such a scenario simply doesn't reckon seriously with the politics of the issue or offer any transformative possibility starting from the world as it is. Finally, and on a positive note, the Save Our Schools proposal implicitly recognises that the fight for public education has to extend far beyond simply winning adequate resourcing, as essential as this is. We have to transform the unlevel playing field in which two sectors can charge fees as they wish, enrol and expel who they like, open and close when and where they want, while the public sector has all the responsibilities. Unless we do this, Australia will continue to have, as SOS rightly points out, one of the most socially segregated education systems in the developed world. We will only start to change this if we build on this urgent conversation about policy solutions that address the fundamental issues ailing our schools and which can open up new political space in which transformative change becomes possible. The Dog's response. Chris Bonner and Tom Greenswell and Trevor Cobbold are still romancing about needs policies and the resource standards. The needs policies have inevitably become greed's policies for the private schools and failed. They cannot and will not succeed. All official funding figures leave out the billion-dollar purple economy of taxation exemptions or taxation expenditures. Private schools are charities in law on the basis of being both religious and educational institutions, and, politically and accountably, they have become almost a law unto themselves. Max Wallace wrote about this in his book on the purple economy. In the current Australian circumstances, an integrated system is just an invitation for the private religious sector to further game the system and deprive the public system of further funding. Unfortunately, this is the inevitable result of entanglement of religion with the state. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. But that's all. We've been spending a bit of time on some pretty meaty stuff, pretty meaty issues. So let's have a break before we come back and expect you to concentrate on even meatier facts and figures.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You're still listening to the Dogs program. I think a lot of people realise that in many ways Australia is starting to imitate America. And we did have an article from Oxfam where their research has recorded that the number of Australian billionaires hold the total wealth of $686 billion. So we are getting our own kleptocrats here in Australia who are funding people like Pauline Hanson, and who want monoculture, not multiculturalism. But of course, we're all for public schools which are open to all children, and it doesn't matter what cultures they come from. It's important that we learn to live together. But unfortunately, our private school system is dividing our children, and they are getting a lot more money than the public system at the moment, and there is a lot of problems in our society as a result. So let's hear, shall we, from Sorrel, who's going to tell us the latest research on the Save Our Schools website from Trevor Cobold and the research he's been doing with the funding in the Queensland sector.
Thanks, Jean. This article is written by Trevor Cobold and is entitled Queensland Private Schools Have a Large Resource Advantage Over Public Schools. New figures show that private schools have a major resource advantage over public schools in Queensland. Government funding increases have favoured Catholic and independent schools over public schools since 2009. Public schools remain massively underfunded for the challenges they face, while independent and Catholic schools are overfunded. The favourable funding for private schools is a key factor behind the enrolment shift to these schools. Updated figures published by the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, ACARA, show that the total income per student in public schools in 2024 was $20,164, compared to $26,132 per student in independent schools and $22,649 in Catholic schools. The total income per student in independent schools is 30% more than that of public schools and 12% higher in the case of Catholic schools. Government funding accounts for 72% of the income of Queensland Catholic schools and 57% of the income of independent schools. In 2024, Catholic schools received $16,356 per student from the Commonwealth and the Queensland governments, and independent schools received $14,893. Commonwealth and Queensland government funding for private schools adjusted for wage and price increases to estimate the real increase in human and material resources increased by much more than that for public schools between 2009 and 2024. Total government funding increased by $2,932 per student in Catholic schools and by $3,036 per student in independent schools, compared to $2,398 in public schools. Government funding per student for independent schools increased by 45.3% and 37.8% in Catholic schools, compared to 23.7% in public schools. Commonwealth government funding for Catholic schools increased by $2,847 per student and by $2,979 for independent schools, compared to only $1,327 for public schools. Queensland government funding for public schools increased by $1,071 per student, by $85 per Catholic student, and by $57 per student in independent schools. The increase in total income per student in Catholic and independent schools was much larger than for public schools. It increased by $4,013 in Catholic schools and by $3,253 in independent schools, compared to $2,369 in public schools. It is disgraceful that governments continue to ensure that independent schools have a huge resource advantage over public schools, when it is public schools that do the heavy lifting in overcoming socioeconomic disadvantage to improve equity in education, increase workforce skills, and strengthen social cohesion. income per student in independent schools is 30% higher than in public schools. Government funding provides a significant proportion of this resource advantage. Yet, research by Save Our Schools shows that only 12% of independent students in Queensland are from low-income families, compared to 33% of public school students, using 2023 figures. Independent schools enrol only 8% of all low-income students in Queensland, while public schools account for 82% of these students. Moreover, only 10% of independent schools in Queensland are disadvantaged schools, defined as having over 50% of students from the lowest socio-educationally advantaged quartile, compared to 33% of public schools. Independent schools account for only 5% of all disadvantaged schools, and while public schools account for 90%. Total income per student in Catholic schools was 12% higher than in public schools in 2024. However, only 14% of Catholic students were from low-income families, compared to 33% in public schools in 2023. Catholic schools enrol only 10% of all disadvantaged students in Queensland, compared to 82% of these students by public schools. In addition, only 7% of Catholic schools are disadvantaged. Over 50% of students from the lowest socio-educationally advantaged quartile, compared to 33% of public schools. Catholic schools account for only 5% of all Queensland disadvantaged schools, compared to 90% by public schools. The Report on Government Services 2026 shows that 82% of students from low socio-educational families in Queensland, 80% of Indigenous students and 83% of remote and very remote area students are enrolled in public schools. Private schools have an effective resource advantage because they educate a much smaller proportion of socially disadvantaged students than public schools. This means that a lower proportion of private school income is absorbed by disadvantaged students and more is available for less disadvantaged students. Clearly, government funding in Queensland is not being directed at the students and schools most in need. The pattern of government funding, fees and other income and total income per student have varied between school sectors over the period from 2009 to 2024. Real government, Commonwealth and Queensland government funding for public schools flatlined from 2009 to 2015, increasing by only $55 per student. There was a more significant increase from $10,192 per student in 2015 to $10,935 in 2018. Over the next 3 years, there was only a small increase of $117 per student to $11,052 per student in 2021. Over the next 2 years, it increased by $1,467 per student to $12,519, with little change in 2024. Commonwealth government funding steadily increased from 2013 after little change from 2009. It increased from $1,483 per student in 2013 to $2,899 in 2024, despite a small decrease in 2019. Queensland government funding was quite variable over the period. It increased by $308 per student between 2009 and 2012, but then fell by $569 per student in 2015. There was a small increase of $107 per student to 2018, and a further increase of $283 to 2020. It then fell by $166 per student in 2021, but increased to $1,217 to 2023. It again fell in 2024, this time by $109 per student. By contrast, government funding for Catholic and independent schools increased steadily since 2009. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, look, thank you so much, Sol. That's pretty meaty stuff, and we have cut it in half. We'll come back to the Queensland situation next week. But for the moment, we're going overseas to the UK and Korea with Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to start out in the UK, where it turns out that if you put VAT or GST on private school fees, it doesn't cause major problems to them at all. As you know, when the Labor Party came to power over there, they promised to reform education by placing VAT on private school fees. And people decried it as it's going to cause a mass exodus from private schools into the public sector, which the public sector was said couldn't handle it. Anyway, it turns out that hasn't happened. This article is from The Guardian, and it's by Richard Adams, who's the education editor. And it begins from the Friday 19th of June 26th. And the headline is, VAT on private school fees not caused exodus to state sector, says Bridget Phillipson. It begins, Education Secretary cites admissions data for England, saying Labor is rebalancing the system to focus on 94% of kids in state schools. It goes on, adding VAT to private school fees has failed to trigger an exodus of pupils into the state sector, despite widespread speculation that it would. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has said. The Labor government applied 20% VAT to private school fees from the start of 25. They had previously been exempt from the tax. Newly published admissions data for England showed there had been no influx towards state schools since then. Phillipson said, the predicted exodus from private schools simply hasn't happened, and today's data proves it. Critics warned state schools would be swamped with new pupils. They were wrong. They said private schools would close en masse. They haven't. We're rebalancing the system to focus on the 94% of kids in state schools, a majority that has been sidelined for too long. The admissions data is the first since the VAT was added, taken from applications to state schools made in October last year for places in the school year starting next September. The former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, was amongst those who predicted that up to 90,000 children would enter the state sector after the addition of the VAT. The figures from the Department of Education actually showed a decline in overall applications for both primary and secondary school places this year, while nearly 85% of families received their first choice of secondary school place, higher than in 2025 and 2024. Local authorities in central London, with some of the highest proportions of privately educated children, showed no signs of a rise in applications. Hammersmith and Fulham and Kensington and Chelsea both received fewer applications, both, it should be four of them there, received fewer applications for places in September compared with the two previous years. But there was a slight increase in Islington, where the share of families getting their first preference of secondary school dropped from 68 to 66%. The Department of Education said that 94% of secondary applicants and 98% of primary applicants in London received an offer from one of their six preferred schools and noted that that is not a system under pressure. In Surrey, which was singled out as a likely hotspot for private school defections, there were fewer applications for secondary places this year, while in Kent there was an increase of 2%. However, experts cautioned that the falling birth rate and post-Brexit population shifts may partly mask any impact of the VAT increase. The Department of Education's 26 school survey found that while the number of children in schools of all types fell by 1.2%, the numbers at independent schools were down by 3.8%, a drop of 22,000 compared with 2025. The Independent Schools Council said that its members have lost 30,000 pupils since the introduction of VAT. Although the group's membership includes schools in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, while the Department of Education's figures are for England alone and include hundreds of private schools that are not ISC members. The census recorded a continuing increase in the number of private schools operating in England, noted by Philipson. The Department of Education census showed an increase of 41 private schools in 2026, but the figure was boosted by 88 more independent schools, special schools opening, offsetting the 47 mainstream schools that closed. The Department of Education said that VAT on private school fees was raising more than had been initially forecast and is now likely to bring in £1.8 billion annually by 2930. The addition of VAT was a Labor manifesto pledge during the 24 general election, and the money raised was to be put towards hiring an additional 6,500 teachers by the end of this parliament. The National Audit Office recently cast doubt on the Department of Education's ability to meet that pledge, which is aimed at recruiting more secondary special needs and further education teachers. And that's the end of the article. But it goes to show that, you whack a tax on private schools, people will not budge because the people who can afford them, those schools in the first place, aren't bothered by an extra 20%. Turns out it's okay to tax private schools, just like any other business. Now, we're going to have a look at an interesting story. Now, I don't know if any of you watch K-dramas. They're huge. It's like K-pop affected music back in the in the 90s, really, or early 2000s especially, and whether you're Gangnam styling around. But K-pop and K-dramas have taken over the world, becoming huge in Asia, especially in India and other countries where they're increasing their people learning Korean as a result because they want to watch the TV shows in their original. Now, one of the ones that is actually causing quite a lot of interest in the education world is one where they basically, I've seen part of this show myself. It's called, the show is called Cham Education. This is still me talking, but I'm going to an article in a minute. But Cham Education is about a bunch of teachers whose children have been harmed by bullying, and they set about organising a like an FBI for schools, and they go into schools and they find the bullies and they punish the bullies and they punish the parents of the bullies and these draconian methods. It's actually like a little fascist state within a state in these schools. They go into schools where complaints have been had, find the truth, whether or not it's a teacher causing a trouble or students. Anyway, it's causing a lot of talk as people around the world who watch this show saying that's happening in my school. Anyway, it's an interesting take on education, and I thought, therefore, we might just do a little quick story on it. This appeared in Mail Business, which is Korea's number one economic media site, and it's by Cho Sung Shin, and it's come out in the last week. Here we are, the 17th of June, 26, and it is. The article is, Netflix drama Cham Education is gaining sympathy from viewers around the world. The background of works dealing with problems in the Korean education field at the same time in dozens of countries is the reality that violence against teachers and infringement of teaching rights have become a global phenomenon. According to the global OTT ranking aggregation site Flix Patrol on the 17th, the Netflix series True Education, which was released on the 5th, ranked first in overall English and non-English integrated global TV shows within a week of its release. Cham Education is the name in English. It entered the top 10 in 93 countries and ranked first in 45 countries, including Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Thailand, Vietnam and Korea. It also showing unusual reactions in Europe, North America, ranking second in Spain, France and Germany and eighth in the United States and the United Kingdom. In particular, foreign viewers are responding, it's like the problem our school is facing. The United States is known to be the most serious place for violence against teachers. In the 24-25 National Centre for Education Statistics survey, 21% of teachers said they were worried about being attacked by students at school. The FBI's Special Report on Crime in Schools 2020-2024, released in August last year, has more than 1 million criminal cases in schools over the past 5 years. The UK is in a similar situation. In a survey released earlier this year by the British Teachers Union, NASUWT, 20% of teachers said they'd been hit or punched by students, and 30% were shoved. 38% were shoved. One in four experienced student violence at least once a semester. In particular, more than 60% of threats using weapons were attributed to elementary school students. In this environment, 62% of teachers complained of stress caused by student aggression, and 52% said they considered leaving the teaching profession. In France, a 15-year-old student stabbed on campus at a school in Nantes last year, and Prime Minister François Bureau himself urged the school to strengthen security, and the issue of teaching authority has spread to political agenda. France has a hardline system that allows permanent expulsion by holding an on-campus disciplinary committee in case of assault on teachers, but the number of cases has not decreased at the scene. Even though the drama Champ Education is based on unfamiliar Korean educational fields, it cannot be explained by the exhilaration of Kwon Gwonseon Jijak, the Church of the United States. Not quite sure what that means, but it must have a Korean translation. That's the end of the article. Look, it is just an interesting take on, it's not only on aggression by students on teachers, it's also about interpersonal relationships between students and bullying, and also bullying by teachers. It's quite an interesting show, even though I would hesitate to think that any of the methods used in it would be ever gained acceptance. Anyway, with that sort of light-hearted story, I thought I might pass you back to the headquarters and wish you all a very nice weekend. Cheerio.
Well, let's have a quick break, shall we, before we come back to the very best part of our program.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because here is our wonderful producer, Dale, who's going to tell us just how important our public schools are, not only to our teachers who are employed in them, but also to the parents and the general community. They know what's going on. Let's hear about what the polling suggests.
Thanks, Jean. This is a media release from the New South Wales Teachers Federation. Polling and focus groups show voters are ready to reward a government that invests in class prep. New polling shows a vote-changing political opportunity for any New South Wales politician who commits to giving teachers the time they need to properly plan for the classroom. New South Wales public school teachers are asking for 2 additional hours of preparation time per week to plan lessons, collaborate with colleagues, and manage the growing complexity of modern classrooms. Primary teachers currently receive around 2 hours of preparation time a week, a figure unchanged since the 1980s. Secondary teachers have had no increase since the 1950s. In 2021, the independent Gallup inquiry into the teaching profession recommended the additional 2 hours as a matter of urgency. Since then, the number of students with disability in New South Wales public schools has risen by 75% to more than 220,000, with 86% learning in mainstream settings. Key findings from the polling of New South Wales voters: Voters back teacher investment above all else. 42% identify investing in and supporting teachers as the single most effective way to improve public education, more than double the next option, and well ahead of new buildings, more principal autonomy, or any other option tested. It is a bipartisan view across Labor, Coalition, and Greens voters. Voters recognise the pressures on teachers today. In focus groups accompanying the survey, participants spoke not just about the time and workload pressures on teachers, but also the need to accommodate all the different needs that constitute the modern classroom. Our schools have changed, just as our state has changed. For focus group participants, comparing classrooms today to previous eras is chalk and cheese. Support for preparation time is deep and resilient. Even after voters hear the cost counter-argument, net support remains, underpinned by voters' belief that education should be among the highest priorities for government spending. The counter-argument that increasing investment in education might come at a cost to other government services did not just fail to land. Focus groups conducted alongside the survey found it generated anger, with participants calling it a false choice and politically manipulative. Saying that education is not as important, that annoys me a little bit. I feel a bit of anger building up. Parents don't need to be convinced, said New South Wales Teachers Federation President Henry Rajendra. Every day they see the teacher who stays back, who knows their child, and who's taken the time to understand what that particular kid needs in order to learn. They also see what happens when teachers are running on empty. The public are clear-eyed about what will make the biggest difference to their children's education, and they're right. Teachers in New South Wales have had the same preparation time for decades, yet in that time, classrooms have been transformed. There are far more students with disability, more complex needs, more cultural and linguistic diversity, and a curriculum that keeps changing. An independent inquiry recommended we fix this 4 years ago, and the evidence is overwhelming. The expert advice is clear, and the community is behind it. This is simply about giving teachers the time to do their jobs properly so that every child gets the education they deserve. Back to you, Jean.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because here is Andy with some news for us and also the section on our great state school. Our great state school this week is chosen because it's an example of when the local member, the parents, and the teachers all get together and just tell the government that they want their school to be properly serviced. And they're not going to put up with being put off any longer. So let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's Great State School of the Week is Kensington Primary School. And from their website, Kensington Primary School, located 4 kilometres from the centre of Melbourne, is one of the oldest schools in Victoria. It has served its vibrant and rapidly changing inner city neighbourhood since 1881 and is proud of the role it plays in community life today. The school community believes that a diversity of cultures and values brings a richness to the school, developing tolerance and understanding and exposing students to other ways of thinking. Just under half the students are from language backgrounds other than English. The school community includes a significant number of families from Horn of Africa countries, as well as smaller numbers from Asian and European families. And the principal's message: since 1881, Kensington Primary School has been educating a diverse range of children, and the community continues to celebrate and embrace this diversity. The school seeks to maintain a respect for each other's beliefs and different cultural backgrounds that really enlivens this community. There is a strong focus on learning through the arts, and the children are given many opportunities to perform, create, and grow in confidence. There is a very high level of participation in the school from the parent community. Many of the programs and school improvements have been achieved and many programs enhanced due to this significant input from the parent body. The children are engaged in many extracurricular activities, and as a result, they are encouraged to be actively involved, to explore and learn new things, meet new people, and challenge themselves. The children work cooperatively and support each other in their learning and are encouraged to set goals and reflect upon their achievements. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. Current enrolment, 427. and the ICSIA value above average at 1,153, representative of a diverse inner Melbourne community. The upper 25% of socio-educational advantage makes up 62% of students at this school. The second level, 20%. The third quartile of socio-educational advantage makes up 12% of students, and the lowest quartile, 6%, with 36% having a language background other than English and 1% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $1.326 million and from the Victorian Government, $4.9 million. Private fees and contributions add $281,673, and other private contributions make up $201,000. And that works out at only $14,764 per pupil. Capital expenditure, $6.2 million over 3 years. This is a school doing an amazing job on less than average funding. Now back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Kensington Primary School, and not only the teachers, but also the parents and the students and the surrounding community. Great community up there. But our time is gone. If you want to find out more about the Dogs, of course, there is our website at www.adogs.info. So here I have to remind you of the 3CR Radiothon, which is still open, and in the next few weeks we hope that we'll be able to tell you how well the Dogs did. And I also have to thank our wonderful producer Dale and her offsidey Andy, and also Sorrel and Jeff, and of course Maddie. So from all of us here at 3CR on the Dogs, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.